Welcome to the Black History Podcast. As always, I'm your host, Nashad Carrington. Today we have a very special piece of history to present to you, and I know sports fans will love this. On this occasion, I'm getting the opportunity to bring you the show live here from one of the most historic sports cities in the country, St. Louis, Missouri. And buried in the annals of the history of sport and buried even deeper in the histories of hockey is the story of the Colored Hockey League of the Maritimes. Now, we're definitely going to get into the story, the people, and the legacies that the league left behind, but for now, let's give our research credit where it's due. You'll be able to find a link to this book on our website, but most of the information for this episode is compiled from two men who did just a great job of the research and are really the ones who brought this story to the light. There is and remains actually only one book ever written about the Colored Hockey League. You know, it's mentioned here and there, but there's only one book that's truly dedicated to it, its history, the persons behind it, and the players itself. You know, in 2004, two brothers, George and Daryl Frosty, actually published a book titled Black Ice, after conducting extensive research on the long-forgotten league and the topic. Black Ice is also credited with restoring the history and legacy of early African-Canadian hockey nearly a century after it had been removed, forgotten, and really had just disappeared from Canadian and North American historical records. With certainty, we can only date black hockey to the early 1870s, yet we do know that hockey and black history in Nova Scotia have parallel roots going back almost 100 years. Now, I will preface this episode with this. All of the cities that we're going to refer to are coming from Canada. So don't expect, if you're in the United States, to recognize many of these cities. We are talking about provinces and city locations that are in Canada. Okay. So among the first reports of hockey being played occur in 1815 along the isolated northwest arm just south of Halifax. Now, the date is important for the simple fact that as late as October 1815, the region was not home to a large white settlement, but was instead the site of a very small black enclave. In fact, four black families originally from the Chesapeake Bay area, now that is the U.S., with a total of 15 children, a lot of kids between four families, had relocated and settled on the arm. It is reported that the families of Council, Williams, Monroe, and Liel received adequate food and lodging and employment, and that really just implies that their children were healthy and would have been able to play hockey during the winter months when the arm was frozen and suitable for skating. Were these children actually among the first Canadians to play the game of hockey? An interesting thought right there, but we just don't know. All we can actually say for sure is that the coincidence between the date of the Northwest Arm's black settlement and the first records of hockey being played in the area are really worth hard reflection. Now, historically speaking, the Colored Hockey League was like no other hockey or sports league before or since. Now, primarily located in a province that is reputed to be the birthplace, for my tongue-tiedness, it's reported to be the birthplace of Canadian hockey, the league would in time produce a quality of player and athlete that would rival the best of white Canada. Such was the skill of the teams that they would actually be seen as truly worthy candidates for local representation in the annual national quest for Canada's hockey's ultimate prize, the Stanley Cup. Now, I know anyone who is even the casual sports fan probably knows of the Stanley Cup as being, you know, the NHL's end of the year trophy, similar to the Lombardi trophy in professional football. Well, at the time, the Stanley Cup was actually just for the Canadian national winner. So let's jump forward a little bit. So as we've mentioned, the Colored Hockey League was an all-black ice hockey league founded in Nova Scotia in the year 1895, and it featured teams from across Canada's maritime provinces. The league operated for several decades, as a matter of fact, lasting until around 1925-1930. Now, hundreds of black Canadians played on teams across the Maritimes over several decades, with as many as a dozen teams. Over 400 African-Canadian players from across Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, and Prince Edward Island participated in competition. The league consisted of teams such as the Dartmouth Jubilees, the Halifax Eurekas, we'll hear them mentioned a couple more times, the Truro Sheiks, and the Africville Brown Bombers, the Colored Magnets, and the New Glasgow Speed Boys, just to name a few. Now, the Colored Hockey League would use the teachings of Booker T. Washington, the Bible, and speech resources from the Underground Railroads in their game books and game strategies. Before the Colored Hockey League, white leagues actually played in a very primitive, gentle manner. The Colored Hockey League transformed the game into a fast-paced competition, not different than what we see now. It was formed by Baptist ministers and church administrators who were the sons and grandsons of runaway slaves. According to Fosty, quote, they just looked out onto the ponds and saw all these black kids playing hockey, and they said, well, let's create church leagues. This is how it started, as a friendly game between churches and a way to bring younger people in. Also, you've got to remember that when the younger kids came to church during the time, they were the ones who would take the wagons and also bring in the older people. You know, the thriving, close-knit black communities in the provinces were often centered around their church congregations. But by the later 1800s, the congregations and their ministers were getting old, and the younger ministers needed to find some way to keep kids coming to church. Now, the league's founder, James Kinney, was a lay minister and also the general manager of the Eurekas. He viewed the league as the embodiment of black pride and independence in Nova Scotia. Although there was no official policy of segregation, few black players ever appeared in the rosters of a major Canadian team at the time. Approximately half the players in the Colored Hockey League were from families who came to Canada during the American Revolution, and another quarter actually had relatives who came across the border through the Underground Railroad. As the league was founded in a province that was reputed to be the birthplace of Canadian hockey, the league would in time produce again a quality of player and an athlete that would rival the best of the best in all of Canada, black or white. The games between the black clubs were generally arranged by formal invitation from one team to the other, and the competition amongst and between these teams would have been regionally recognized as worthy candidates to represent the locality in the annual quest for the Stanley Cup. Amateur players became paid professionals as teams started charging fans to watch the games, and eventually, teams would begin to bid on the best players in the open market, which had the effect of bolstering some teams and crippling others. Now, I want you to think, even again, the most casual sports fan, where have we seen this replicated today? This essence of bidding on players in the open market. Some teams get stronger because great players are on the teams. Other teams are weaker because they don't have as great players. We see that across all sports leagues nowadays. That wasn't the case before the Colored Hockey League. Now, most black players actually ended up playing baseball during summer months, which resulted in a more prone to high sticking than was normal at the time, and in fact was possibly the source and inspiration for the slap shot. These black Nova Scotians changed the winter game from, again, that primitive gentleman's pastime of the 19th century to the modern fast-moving game of today. They were led by skilled and educated leadership, and the Colored League emerged as a premier force in Canadian hockey and really supplied the resilience necessary to preserve a unique sports culture that still exists to this day. Unfortunately, their contributions were ignored as hockey players copied elements of the black style and often took credit for black hockey innovations. Now, while I understand full well that there aren't many fans of the ice that actually come from the darker hues, however, if you were to ask a hardcore hockey fan who took the first slap shot, they'll probably tell you it was Hall of Famer Frank Bun Cook. Now, here we go. Again, we said that there was some appropriation of some of the style of the black players into the more prominent leagues without black players being given their credit and due. George Fosty, one of the brothers who wrote Black Ice, he'll give you a different answer to who invented the slap shot. He would tell you that it was Eddie Martin of the all-black Halifax Eurekas in 1906, over 100 years ago. Fosty also says that black goalies weren't afraid to get down on the ice if that's what it took to stop a shot. Now, the standard goaltending style of today, which is that same thing of just selling all out, players laying out, kicking a leg up to save a shot if that's what it takes, was frowned upon 100 years ago, as the, quote, gentlemanly style was a much more reserved style than the gritty, expressive style of the Colored Hockey League. Now, The goalies at the time as well were much more likely to get out and just skate out and take an active part in play. It was a wide open style, in contrast to the more controlled and conservative play that some of the all-white leagues were performing during the day. Now, many of the innovations from the Colored Hockey League were quickly co-opted by white players around the region, very similar to suburban high school basketball players stealing moves that they may see on the city playground. Now, the Colored Hockey League is credited by some as being the first league to allow the goaltender to leave his feet to cover a puck in 1900. Again, this move was not permitted anywhere else until the National Hockey League, which is obviously the NHL as we see today, that was formed in 1917. As Fosty's book is our prevailing authority on this topic, according to their book Black Ice, there was a gentleman named Henry Abraces Franklin who played for the Dartmouth Jubilees, who was actually the first goalie to go down on the ice to stop the puck. Since there is such limited information on the Colored Hockey League, aside from the information that was compiled, by the Fosties, we'll take just a second to touch on some of the pieces of truly verifiable hockey history, primarily the first black players to professionally play hockey in the United States. First up is Willie O'Ree. Willie O'Ree was born on October 15, 1935, in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada. On January 18, 1958, while playing wing for the Boston Bruins in a game against the Montreal Canadiens, he broke the NHL color barrier, becoming the first black player in league history. Now, he only played in two games that year, but he did come back in 1961 to play 43 games. He scored a total of 4 goals and 10 assists in his NHL career, all in 1961. So, the path that many athletes take to reach the big time is often forgotten or overlooked, especially as the minor league system in most sports doesn't have much coverage, and hockey truly is no different. Midway through O'Ree's second minor league season with the Quebec Aces, O'Ree was called up to the Boston Bruins of the NHL to replace an injured player. Now, I want you to keep this in mind as well. O'Ree was 95% blind in his right eye due to being hit there by a puck 2 years prior. Now, this sort of injury, 95% blindness in one eye, would normally have kept him from ever playing in the NHL. However, O'Ree managed to keep it a secret, and he made his NHL debut with the Bruins. In the minor leagues, O'Ree actually won 2 scoring titles in the Western Hockey League, also known as the WHL, between 1961 and 1974. He scored more than 30 goals 4 times, with the high of 38 in 1964-65 season, and again in the 68-69 season. Now, most of O'Ree's playing time was with the WHL's Los Angeles Blades and the San Diego Gulfs. The latter team, the Gulfs, actually ended up retiring his number that hangs from the rafters in the San Diego Sports Arena. O'Ree continued to play in the minors until the age of 43. O'Ree noted that, quote, "Racist remarks were much worse in the U.S. cities than in Toronto and Montreal," end quote, the two Canadian cities that were actually hosting NHL teams at the time, and that fans would often yell things such as "go back to the South" and "how come you're not picking cotton" and other things of that nature. Now, I find that a little ironic, I'll say, and to a certain degree amusing in the level of ignorance, considering the fact that he's Canadian. So I don't really think that he was ever from the South. And I don't think that he would have ever been picking cotton because he was descendant of free slaves who went to Canada, probably through the Underground Railroad. Either way, the level of ignorance in certain racist elements is just baffling sometimes, and comments such as that are just a perfect example. So O'Ree was the first person of African descent to play in the Professional Hockey League, but as we mentioned, he was a black Canadian. So now we'll move to the first black American-born player in the NHL. His name was Valmore James, but he's much better known as Val James. So Val James was born on February 14th, 1957 in Ocala, Florida, my home state, not my home city, but my home state, and raised on Long Island, New York. However, as something that's different for most people who probably are participants of hockey, as really with most sports of picking up for the first time, Val didn't lace up skates for the first time until he was 13 years old. His father had actually taken a position in Commack, Long Island, as the operations manager for an ice skating rink, and that's where his love of the ice came from. Now, Val's landmark on history as being the first Black American player to play in the NHL has really kind of been treated as a footnote in the annals of sports history, especially in comparison to the treatment of the man who broke baseball's color barrier about a generation prior. And of course, we're referring to Jackie Robinson in that point. Now, Val was actually selected by the Detroit Red Wings in the 16th round of the 1977 NHL draft. He was pick number 184. And Val actually only played in 14 games in the NHL before he retired in 1988 because of a shoulder injury. It's kind of unfortunate for such a shortened career. But from the 1978-79 season to the 87-88 season, he did play in the minors, okay? With a couple of choice call-ups being to the NHL, first with the Buffalo Sabres and then with the Toronto Maple Leafs. And he really put up 30 penalty minutes, coupled with 0 points in a total of 11 games. And really, you know, the thing I think that really probably may have messed with his psyche a little bit, because it has to. And we'll get to a quote that he had in just a second. You know, the racially charged slurs that he heard in opposing rinks probably never became any less painful each time he heard them. Each time he was singled out by some ignorant fan or rocket opponent, it's probably just a strong reminder of the hatred that was still lurking and bubbling under the surface. Now, you have to remember, again, we said that O'Ree came into the league in the late 50s, and Val comes into the league in the 70s, and really the mid to late 70s. And so we have a good 20 to 25 year span of time here. And we're still dealing with the same things over and over again, you know, even in the context of sports, not even just socially, but in sports as well. So this is just a quote from Val, just to kind of get you to conceptualize kind of what he was dealing with and how he was, you know, how he's really being taunted. He says, quote, "Imagine every 3 seconds being called something, whether you're of an ethnic nationality or even a woman. Every 3 seconds for 20 minutes a period, which would equate to about 2.5 hours in real time, and multiply that by 40, which signifies 40 games of the year in 10 years, the span that I played. That's a lot of names. If you take a woman and all the names you can call her and use the same formula, then you kind of get a rough idea of how it makes you feel. People can relate to that now because they have something tangible in front of them that they can actually relate to," end quote. Now, being the first U.S.-born Black player in the NHL, Val's career has actually never garnered the same type of recognition reserved for Willie O'Ree in 58. Now, even in Val's time, you know, again, we said 20 to 25-year span of time, but fans were still throwing bananas on the ice and taunting him from the stands and throwing beers at him. And as a matter of fact, once in Boston, an angry mob cracked a team's bus window demanding for the, quote, "nigger" to come out as he and his Sabre teammates left the rink following a game against the Bruins. Now, of course, you know, the determination and really the discovery of the Fosty brothers has not been without some kind of controversy and skepticism. According to George Fosty, quote, "They're angry at us. Some of them have staked their careers on the myth that hockey is a Canadian white man's game. The idea that the game may not have originated from white leagues is, for some people, unsettling. I'm not saying they're bigoted. I know that they're not. They're just closed-minded," end quote. Now, the league was especially surprising to the stereotypical beliefs of whites that Blacks couldn't endure cold climates and we didn't have the ankles strong enough to skate. The league began on ponds, but soon moved to arenas. And although the colored league wasn't given exactly, you know, VIP treatment, games were held late at night and late in the season, so ice surfaces were second-rate and inferior. However, the quality of hockey was not. Right here, it's important for us to point out for remembrance sake that today's stereotypes of the, quote, "stronger and faster, naturally gifted Black athlete" didn't exactly exist back then. And ironically enough, the Colored Hockey League may have thrived because of an entirely other stereotype, which was practically the opposite of today's. The European belief, actually, that Blacks were inferior to whites, even in athletics. Now, Fosty believes that the expectations for Black men playing professional hockey were so low that the games were better than expected, and therefore grew in popularity. Now, equally as important to note is a point that the Fosties make in their characterization of the racial climate at the time. Now, according to their research, there was nothing explicitly stating that Black athletes could not play, but instead, they just weren't invited to play. Now, no one of Black African descent ever appeared on any rosters. And even in their attempts to check the initial rosters in Nova Scotia leagues, hoping to see some Black names, turned up completely empty. Now, NHL rosters have changed just a bit nowadays, but really not to the point of reflecting the racial diversity of the NFL, and certainly not to the point of reflecting the homogeneity of the NBA. And on January 15th, 2002, history was made in the sport, because on this day, the NHL game took place that pitted two very evenly matched teams, the Edmonton Oilers and the St. Louis Blues. Kind of ironic that I'm in St. Louis reporting this. The game, which just so happened to have been played on Martin Luther King's birthday, featured seven Black players, which then and now was actually the largest number of Black players to ever appear in a single game to date. The Oilers had four players, the Blues had three. Now, the Frosties actually claim in quite some detail that what destroyed the Colored Hockey League, in fact, was not racism. It was actually World War I, which killed hundreds of players on the battlefield. The Frosties assert that at one point, 48 Black Canadians died in 1 month alone at the Battle of Cambrai. Essentially that the guys were used as cannon fodder, more than likely put on the front lines. The high point of the league came around in about 1905, according to the Frosties, after which they really accused the elite in the Maritimes of really working hard to undermine the success and impact that the league had. However, they report that the campaign to keep Black players off of the hockey rinks that they shared with the other leagues was very, very subtle. Rather than just straight banning the leagues or forcing them out, their schedules were simply moved further ahead 1 month, knowing that the ice conditions would be bad. When, quote, half the ice is on water, it's really, really tough to skate, and it really slows down the game, and people don't come to the games, and they're just not going to pay to see that. You know, that combined with subtle economic and social pressure eventually crippled the league, which lingered on, you know, just a little bit into the 20s before vanishing almost entirely from the public record in 25. Now, the Frosties also say that most newspapers, with the exception of the Acadian Recorder, barely covered the games, and that actually when they did, they treated the games as a joke. You know, they really just deemed these guys not worthy of recording, you know, and we have just about 400 athletes that they've looked at and they have background information on. And unfortunately, of these 400, they don't really appear in about 99.9% of sources. Now, George and Daryl spent years poring over archived maritime newspapers and church records and interviewing church elders, all in the course of their research. All of that actually culminated again into the name of the book, Black Ice, The Lost History of the Colored Hockey League. And according to the Frosties, they actually plan to continue to piece together this lost chapter of hockey and Black history, and it will take some time and evidence before the Colored Hockey League becomes well-known once more. When they wrote the book, they had actually identified 173 hockey players, and today they're approaching over 400. And over time, as more information comes out, the myths will just hopefully be dispelled. And after O'Ree's stint in the NHL, there were no other Black players in the NHL until another Canadian-born African descendant, Mike Marzen, was drafted by the Washington Capitals in 1974. There were 17 Black players in the NHL as of the mid-2000s, the most prominent being a Canadian and also a Colorado Avalanche forward, Jerome Ignala. Art Dorrington was the first Black player to ever sign an NHL contract in 1950 with the New York Rangers organization, but you know, he actually never made it past the minor league levels. NHL players are now required to enroll in a diversity training seminar before each season, and racially based verbal abuse is punished while on the ice through suspensions and fines. While O'Ree was the first Black player in the NHL, Larry Kwong, a Canadian of Chinese descent, was actually the first person to ever break the racial barrier in the NHL. He actually got a chance to play one game for the New York Rangers against the Montreal Canadiens in 1948. Now, Robin Bawa was the first man of Indian descent to play in the NHL. He actually scored 6 goals, 1 assist, in 61 games while collecting 60 penalty minutes. He was in that box quite a bit. Now, O'Ree was named the Director of Youth Development for the NHL Diversity in 1998 and has been has really been an enduring symbol of the league's frequency to overlook moments of diversity. But really, that's not enough to really tap into that untapped fan base. And by that, I'm referring to the African-American population in some of these cities. In 1998, when the Washington Capitals were in the Stanley Cup Finals, the Associated Press actually asked the NHL about indifference in the city's African-American community, because we know that DC has a very, very large African-American population. Well, the then spokeswoman Bernadette Mansour replied that the league doesn't keep stats on the racial makeup of fans, yet it knows that their fan base is not as diverse as they would like. Now, it's one thing to sell black fans on Willie O'Ree and another African-American player named Mike Grier, but it's another when you can sell them on the influence of black athletes in shaping today's game. This is not a white society. This is a mixed society with over 200 cultures infused together. And if you're really gonna attract African-American kids to this sport, you gotta let them know that there are black heroes, there are Native American heroes, there are Chinese heroes, there are Indian heroes, there are heroes who don't come from what we typically think of as hockey fans. You've got to bring down the cost of hockey as well. It's a very expensive sport. I played baseball my whole life growing up. It's a very expensive sport as well. You know, but baseball has that permeation to get through. We're able, again, to see those heroes, Jackie Robinson, Willie Mays, even though he got tainted with a steroid scandal, Barry Bonds. But we just don't see that in the same way for hockey. As a matter of fact, you know, just to put some figures out there, about 50% of people who live in New York City are either at or below the poverty level. And again, you're just not going to be able to grab those people to play hockey when the costs are so high. And in fact, in the 1920s in New York City, they had hockey leagues in the high schools in New York. They can't afford that now. The members of the Black Hockey League, they were innovators, they were entertainers, they were trailblazers, and their remarkable journey from being the sons and grandsons of escaped slaves to professional hockey players is one of the most regrettably worst kept secrets in sports history. You know, it really is truly a shame that the Colored Hockey League isn't recognized in the ways that it could and should be. And, you know, here at the Black History Podcast, we continually touch on instances of our history that have either been whitewashed or trampled on. And this clearly is no different. You know, this episode really stood out to me when it was brought, primarily because I've never really known members of the diaspora to play hockey in any strong fashion. And I can really remember my first visit to an NHL game. It was back in 2012, and it was a match between the Capitals and the Devils in New Jersey. And I really can still envision in my mind and feel it in my spirit that isolating feeling that myself and the woman that I was dating at the time felt when we were sitting in the stands. We thought it would just be something fun. And don't get me wrong, the game was entertaining. It was fun. But it was really an isolating feeling when, you know, the rest of the audience, well, while being very nice and more than welcoming, we're the only ones in the arena that really look like us. And then to not see any people on the ice that looked like us either, you know, it's tough to really enjoy the environment that you're in those circumstances sometimes. You know, and that's really in strong contrast to the feelings that we had just a few hours difference when we actually got a chance to see the Nets play in the same arena. Now, even while at the Nets game, while the audience of the lower bowl where we were sitting was predominantly Caucasian, it was really actually a bit more comforting to see the players on the court reflecting my color and, you know, looking like me. Now, you know, a huge part of that could be played to the fact that obviously I understand the game of basketball. I can understand the logic and the strategy that goes into it, but, you know, I just don't know. I didn't really know hockey that well at the time. I learned it from people around me, but, you know, I just didn't know it as well at the time. So maybe that played a huge part to it. You know, but either way, the pioneering ways of O'Ree and Val, it's inspirational in its own right, and the ways their contribution have been overlooked and overshadowed really is disheartening. You know, but nonetheless, while we champion the achievements of resilience in the likes of Jackie Robinson and Earl Lloyd and Fritz Pollard, we must do the same for those who endure through the racial toughness of hockey as well. And if you don't know, Earl Lloyd was the person that broke the color barrier in the NBA. Fritz Pollard was the person who broke the color barrier in the NFL. Now, that being said, though I can skate relatively well, in fact, I've never had the occasion to play ice hockey, even though I lived in New Hampshire and Boston for a bit. You know, and I can definitely ask that we take a quick moment to reflect and remember those that came before, even in the most obscure sports for our culture. But I do believe that the compilation of the league and the way that they were able to do it and achieve, it proves over and over again that there's no task or sport or quest that our people can't excel and compete. In closing, please be sure to check us out every week for new and updated topics. In the event you have any questions or general commentary about this episode, please feel free to visit our website at www.theblackhistorypodcast.com or www.thisiscarrington.com and navigate to the podcast tab at the top. Now, as we develop and grow, you will find an archive of each episode, plans for future episodes, as well as additional links to books and resources that will help you in the journey to self-enlightenment. We encourage you to share our episodes with your friends, your family, your children, your grandchildren, your coworker, your next door neighbor, somebody that you're just randomly walking down the street and pass. You know, just share our history with everyone because it's there and we should know it. Send us your feedback as well. Suggest new topics, events, or people we should cover. Or if you just wish to drop us a line and give us your thoughts or perspectives to an episode we've done, we will make every best effort to include listener mail or commentary to future episodes as it comes in. Now, please, as we take this journey together, we will do our best to present the diaspora in the most objective light, with some occasional commentary presented. But if you come across any errors or mistakes, let us know. Because as we like to say here, only steel can sharpen steel. Take care, and hopefully we'll see you next week.